Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your Country of Origin Labeling Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for questions and comments following the presentation. If you would like to submit a question or comment at any time during the webinar, you may use the chat box located on the lower right-hand side of your screen. Simply type your message into the box and click on the send button. If you should require assistance throughout the conference, please press star zero. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Janet Riley. Ma'am, the floor is yours.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for our press conference today to announce the response of eight meat and livestock associations to the mandatory country of origin labeling rule published in May 2013. You should be receiving a press release at this very moment about our action. If you're having trouble accessing the webinar, the press release contains a link to the a PDF of the slides. So you should be able to access those. You can also check the website www.meetami.com. This is being recorded, and we will be posting a recording of this on our website at the conclusion. There may be a 2 to 4 hour delay, but there will be a recording posted today. Our speakers today include Mark Dopp, American Meat Institute's Senior Vice President of Regulatory Affairs and General Counsel, and Kate Stetson, a partner with Hogan Lovells. I'm going to turn it over to Mark, and he'll turn it over to Kate, and at the conclusion of the slides, we will open it up to question and answer. So with that, please welcome Mark Dopp.
Thank you, Janet. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for taking the time out of a busy day to join us to discuss the lawsuit that was filed. Before I turn it over to Kate and invite her to explain to you the various causes of action that are included in the complaint, I thought it would be useful for everybody to take a little step back in time and review both the timeline as well as what the final rule that was published in May includes. So country of origin goes back in time all the way. Some of you have been working on this probably as long as I have, even before the 2002 Farm Bill, but for purposes of this conversation, let's remember that the 2002 Farm Bill included mandatory country of origin labeling language. In 2003, the Agricultural Marketing Service published a proposed rule that was exceedingly burdensome, and I might add is extraordinarily similar to the final rule that was published this past May. That proposed rule prompted a fair amount of angst both within the industry and in Congress, which ultimately, after several delays, Congress ultimately amended in the 2008 Farm Bill, the statute, the country of origin statute that is, incorporating into that statute what we now know as categories A, B, C, and D. From that 2008 Farm Bill, AMS ultimately promulgated a final rule that they put into that went into effect in January of 2009. That was a rule that, although the vast majority of the industry has long maintained that mandatory country of origin labeling is unnecessary and unwarranted, it was at least a rule that some of the industry could find palatable, for lack of a better term. Obviously, the governments of Mexico and Canada ultimately concluded that the rule was not palatable because of the discrimination that Mexican and Canadian producers in particular were suffering. That led to those governments filing a complaint against the United States before the WTO. In 2011, the initial panel within the WTO found on several grounds that the final rule was not compliant with the United States obligations under the WTO. And ultimately in 2012, the appellate body for the WTO also found the United States out of compliance, which prompted then in turn the WTO to set a May 23, 2013 compliance date. That date is the date at which, of course, the United States is supposed to come into compliance. That compliance date, next slide please, Eric. That compliance date then, of course, prompted the Ag Marketing Service to publish the proposed rule that we're all familiar with in March of 2013. That proposed rule, as I mentioned, is eerily similar to the proposal from 2013. And in May 23, 2013, USDA published a final rule, which, as best we can tell, if the agency considered the vast array of comments pointing out the array of issues or problems that are attended to that final rule, did little, if anything, to affect their decision. So what we have is a final rule that was published on, that went into, not only published on May 23, but also went into effect on that very day as well. So what does the final rule do? It does, in effect, two things. It requires companies to label covered commodities, and this only has to do with muscle cuts, not ground beef and not the fruit and vegetables and not the, you know, ginseng and macadamia nuts, et cetera, but muscle cut covered commodities, to declare the country of origin with respect to three production steps: where the animal was born, where it was raised, and where it was slaughtered. Importantly also, because of that labeling requirement, in effect, the rule eliminates the commingling that was so significant and so important to a number of companies in terms of being able to comply with the final rule that was published in 2009. What the absence of commingling does is it eliminates the ability or requires the segregation of livestock and the products derived therefrom throughout the entire supply chain. In other words, at the feed yard, at the packing house, throughout the distribution centers, all the way to the retail customer, products have to be segregated and cannot be commingled. Next slide, please. As we stated, as AMI and a number of other the organizations that are plaintiffs in this case, the message to USDA was that if the proposed rule that was published in March of this year was put into effect, it would put at risk a number of companies and plants, as well as a number of hog and cattle producers at risk of going out of business. One of the problems with the final rule is that it ignores the import of livestock from Canada and Mexico. It ignores the seasonality, the lack of uniformity in that distribution, and some other problems. I think it's noteworthy, and I think I said when we had a little conference call when the rule was announced, that it's noteworthy that in 2009, AMS was unable to articulate any measurable, quantifiable benefit to that final rule, and noted that the economic benefit would be small. Well, in 2013, the agency believes that the incremental economic, and this is a quote from the preamble, believes that the incremental economic benefits from the labeling of production steps will be comparatively small relative to those that were discussed in the 2009 final rule. In other words, the benefits in 2009 were small, and the benefits in 2013 are comparatively small relative to the small benefits from 2009. When weighed against the significant costs, we think that this rule doesn't make any sense. Next slide, please. As I said, in our comments and the comments of organizations such as NAMA and AMP and Southwest and others, the universal theme, or one of the universal themes, was that this rule will essentially pick winners and losers. This slide is just a sort of pictorial view of how things could come about, where the problems lie. Obviously, along the northern and southern borders, facilities that are more heavily reliant on livestock from Mexico and Canada will be put at risk. And one of the primary reasons for that is it's very clear if one looks at the comments from the retail sector that given the absence of commingling and the threat, the tenet to the enforcement of the rule, those companies, those retailers who previously were willing to take the mixed origins of products, many of them will abandon that, which will in turn put these facilities at risk. Next slide, please. So as we were preparing this PowerPoint, we decided that picture, again, was worth 1,000 words and sort of point out the intellectual inconsistency in the rule and, in fact, in the statute. So we call this a tale of two tenderloins. We have two pigs, as you can see, one of whom was born in Canada, traveled 100 miles to go to a plant, to a farm in Minnesota, is raised in that Minnesota farm, and slaughtered in a Minnesota plant. Right next to it is another pig that was born in Iowa, sent to that same Minnesota farm, I might add, raised in the same farm, fed the same grain, subject to the same veterinary practices, and sent to the same Minnesota plant. Now, the hog on the right, if the tenderloin from that pig is sent to a retailer and is a covered commodity, the current rule would require that the label say born, raised, and slaughtered in the U.S. If, on the other hand, the tenderloin is marinated, the honey mustard that we've become familiar with and other flavored tenderloins we see out there, there would be no labeling requirement. That product would be exempt because processed products are exempt from mandatory cool. If, on the other hand, a packer processor or the retailer elected to label that product with a country of origin, per Food Safety and Inspection Service policy, that label would read product of the U.S., not born, raised, and slaughtered in the U.S. Compare and contrast that to the pig on the left that was, again, fed the same grain, subject to the same veterinary services on the same farm in Minnesota before it went to the same packing plant in Minnesota. If that tenderloin from that pig is sent to a restaurant, it too is exempt from mandatory country of origin labeling because mandatory cool only applies to retail covered commodities. If the product instead is exported, the label that would be on there would be a function of what the Korean export requirements are, and in this case, that would say product of the U.S. And finally, if the product, if the tenderloin from that pig is ultimately sold as a covered commodity at retail, it would say instead, born in Canada, raised and slaughtered in the U.S. Ironically, the bacon from both of those pigs, if sold to the very same grocery store, would both be exempt and would have to bear no labeling. But if they did, the bacon from both pigs, again, would say product of the U.S. per FSIS policy. Next slide, please. To highlight the problem attendant to commingling, companies, retailers were able to say, for example, product of U.S., Canada, or product of U.S., Mexico, when they were able to co-mingle the Category A and Category B products, for example. Here we have an example of a beef cut, the animal from a steer born in Juarez, Mexico, raised and slaughtered in Amarillo. May not be put in the same tray because you can't commingle the products from the steak that is from an animal that is born in Amarillo, raised in the same feedlot as the animal that comes up from Mexico, and slaughtered in the same Amarillo packing house. This highlights the problem attendant to the absence of commingling. So next slide, please. So as Janet said earlier, and before I turn it over to Kate, the organizations listed on this slide are co-plaintiffs in a suit challenging both the regulation and perhaps even the statute itself, arguing that it is illegal. And I think for purposes of explaining the several causes of action that are incorporated into the complaint, I'm now going to turn it over to Kate Stetson from Hogan Lovells. Kate?
Thanks, Mark, and hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'm going to walk all of you through the three main components of our court challenge to the final regulation. And I'm going to go in the order in which they appear in the complaint. There is a constitutional challenge, there is a statutory challenge, and then there is a more sort of classic Administrative Procedure Act or APA challenge. So taking it from the top, our count one of our complaint is that the COOL regulations violate the Constitution because they compel commercial speech without a sufficiently significant or substantial government interest. The First Amendment, of course, protects your right to speak. It also protects your right not to speak, including companies' right not to be compelled to speak unless the government can show a substantial government interest and that the prohibition or the compulsion to speak is no more extensive than is necessary to advance that interest. So the problem with these regulations, we say in the complaint, and AMI and many of the other plaintiffs said in their comments to the agency before this rule was finalized, these regulations don't serve any governmental interest, much less a substantial one or a significant one. And the defendants actually hardly argue to the contrary. They don't claim that the regulations are justified for a health or safety reason. They don't claim that the current labeling regime is deceptive, nor could they. Instead, the only thing that they offered in their response to the many comments pointing out the potential constitutional problems with the rule they proposed was along the lines of consumer curiosity, that consumers might like to know more information about where their food comes from. The problem is that that argument has already been advanced by governments before in the courts and has been rejected. Mere consumer curiosity is not a substantial government interest. And it's easy to see why, because there's no endpoint to it. Unlike health and safety, unlike fraud or deceptive behavior, there's no interest in providing consumers with more detailed and irrelevant information about where their meat comes from. So that sole government interest that has been proposed has actually already been rejected by the courts. Turning to the second of the three counts of the complaint, this is what I described as the statutory challenge. Whenever an agency issues a regulation, it has to act within the boundaries that are set for it by its authorizing statute. The problem here is that this particular regulation violates the Agricultural Marketing Act, which is the source for the AMS's authority in this regard. The COOL statute does not permit the AMS to require labels specifying the country or countries where an animal was born and raised and slaughtered. And as you heard Mark explain in that chronology earlier, you know, there's some history that's important here as well. Congress back in 2008 specifically rejected the earlier attempt to include that onerous and irrelevant level of detail in a prior proposed regulation that never went into effect. So the statute doesn't authorize AMS to require that level of detail and labeling. It also, importantly, doesn't authorize AMS to essentially restructure producers' production and distribution and packaging systems, all in the name of enforcing this unlawful and overly detailed labeling requirement. So by adopting this onerous regime, AMS hasn't only violated the First Amendment, it's also run afoul of its statutory boundaries. So that's count two. Count three, the third and final count, is what I described as the more classic Administrative Procedure Act claim. Whenever an agency issues a rule, it has to not only act within its statutory boundaries, it has to make sure that it takes action that is not arbitrary and capricious. The action that AMS took here was arbitrary and capricious in a number of respects. To begin with, the justifications that AMS offered for its final rule actually run exactly counter to the evidence in front of the agency. The regulations will not provide consumers with accurate information on which to base purchasing decisions, not least because there are, as Mark mentioned earlier, multiple loopholes in this system that AMS has devised. In addition, the labels that they're requiring actually, in some cases, affirmatively mislead consumers about the origin of the meat products that they're consuming. Importantly as well, you heard Mark reference the WTO proceeding and the resolution of that proceeding by the appellate body and the complaint that Canada and Mexico raised with respect to the old COOL regulation. This regulation does not cure that WTO violation. It exacerbates it. It requires even more onerous and detailed record keeping and will penalize Canadian and Mexican producers even more. That is why AMS had such difficulty in its final rule identifying any benefit from the rule that was consistent with the evidence before it and explaining how this actually carried forward the WTO appellate body's mandate to cure the violation that it found. AMS has, as we say in the complaint, declined to delay implementation of the final rule until the WTO resolved any further proceedings. Meaning that these plaintiffs are now in a position of needing to quickly move to implement the extremely costly, burdensome, onerous, and capricious regulations that are now required of them, all while the WTO proceeding is still hanging out there. And because this final regulation is both violative of the Constitution and of the statute giving AMS its authority, we have taken this legal action to stop it. Let me close by explaining the relief that we are seeking. and I've just sort of adverted to what that is. With respect to any of these three claims, constitutional, statutory, or administrative, relief under any or all of those claims would lead to, we say, a declaration that the regulations that issued on May 23rd are invalid under the First Amendment or the Agricultural Marketing Act or the Administrative Procedure Act or all three. We seek a declaration of invalidity, an injunction against the enforcement of those regulations, a vacator of the final rule, and a remand to AMS if the court concludes that that's even necessary, and any other relief that the court deems proper. So with that, I will pause. Mark, I'll lateral it back to you in case I have overlooked anything that you think is of significance for this audience, and then I think we can open it up to questions.
Operator?
No, thanks, Kate.
Mark, were there any
Go
additional
ahead,
comments?
No, we should move forward with questions.
Okay. Operator, are there any questions? Could you please begin to take questions?
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. If you're using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your headset to provide favorable sound quality. If at any time your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing 1. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Please hold while we poll for questions. And our first question comes from Rod Nichols. Your line is now live.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Just to clarify then, you're challenging only the implementation of the final rule. And if you're successful, then we would go back to the pre-May 2013 COOL rules. Is that right?
Rod, I think that's right. This is Kate. Let me offer one answer, and Mark or others can supplement. We are only challenging the May 2013 final rule. Depending on the relief that the court orders, I think the best prognosis is and the issue remanded back to AMS either to cure the problem or to reinstate the prior regulation. But that last part presumably will be up to AMS once the matter is back in its hands, if the rule is found, as we think it should be, invalid.
And can you comment a bit on the timeline then going forward? Like, has the USDA actually implemented the final rule yet? I think I heard something earlier about there's a long enforcement period before the enforcement would actually start to take effect. So if you can just confirm that, and also if you're successful in court, you know, at what point, I guess, how quickly would things revert back to the old rules?
Sure. Mark, would you like to pick this up, or do you want me to proceed?
Well, yeah, let me add a couple thoughts about both things. One, your question about the rule versus the statute, I think inherent in the case, there is a legitimate question about the constitutionality of the statute. The lawsuit focuses first and foremost on the regulation, but there may be issues raised about the statute itself as well. But we are focusing first, as Kate said, on the regulation. With respect to your question about implementation, the agency, if you may remember, declared the rule to be effective not even upon publishing in the Federal Register. They posted it on their website on May 23rd. They declared it effective as of that date, and it showed up in the Register on the 24th. Now, AMS announced a six-month, quote-unquote, six-month education and industry outreach program. Basically, what they were saying is they're not going to actively enforce the rule for the next 6 months, but I think that statement ignores the fact that it takes a significant amount of time, several months, in fact, for most companies to be able to turn the ship and be able to come into compliance. Purchasing decisions, marketing decisions, a whole host of other decisions have to be made well before that six-month period would run. So we are well into that, we're probably, what, 6 or 7 weeks into that six-month period. There are a number of companies who, even before now, were starting to think about and make decisions about where they were going to spend the money, where they were going to allocate the resources to be able to come into compliance. So while there is this grace period, as a practical matter from a business standpoint, that grace period is extremely short and probably past for some companies.
Okay, and what would the timeline be then? If you're successful in court, how quickly could this all be struck down?
Well, I think, and I'll invite Kate to add on here, but I think one of the other issues is, assuming that the regulation is struck down, and assuming that means that the old regulation somehow goes into effect, remember that regulation was found to be non-compliant with the WTO. It has long been our view that the appropriate solution here is to change the statute to make it more compatible with the realities of the interrelated, integrated North American market for meat and livestock that we have. So we would look to the Congress to fix this.
Are there additional questions?
Yes, our next question comes from Janet Gabbett. Your line is now live.
Thank you. I was wondering if you had any estimate on expenditures that have already been made by meat companies, as Mark just mentioned, to start to come into compliance. And would you be seeking any, damages or anything for that?
Well, Kate, I'll defer to you about the damages. My instinct is that's probably not what we're looking for. What I can tell you is, having spoken to a number of companies, and if you go back and look at the comments, for example, let me give you an example. There's a quite small company down in Texas that filed comments, and we incorporated some of their information as well into our comments. They were looking at expenditures upwards of $250,000 for a facility that processes 150 head a day. Some other facilities were looking at, multiple millions of dollars in expenditures in order to increase the size of their coolers, increase the pens, you're talking about how many additional SKUs or doubling or tripling the number of SKUs. One could look at the expenditures that the retail community would have to incur. If you're asking me how much has been spent to date, I can't tell you that because we haven't canvassed everybody, but I can tell you that I received numerous phone calls from companies asking what was going to take place because they were looking at beginning that expenditure process.
Thank you.
This is Kate. Janet, let me just chime in on your subsidiary question about damages. For various sort of legal and practical reasons, we are not seeking damages on behalf of companies in this case. It is important to our case, just as Mark said, that we establish and we can establish the significant and severe harm across different industries members that flows from this rule. But we're not in a position to seek monetary relief from the government with this type of action.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Philip Asher. Your line is on live.
Yes, and I think those questions are for Kate. First of all, could you explain what you meant by saying that the labeling requirements affirmatively mislead consumers? And number two, at least your second count seems to be based in part on these various exemptions that are in the rule. But aren't those exemptions required by the statute and therefore, wasn't USDA simply doing what Congress told it to do when it provided those the various exemptions that you all have gone through?
Sure. Philip, let me answer each of your questions in turn. You asked about my comment about misleading consumers. I made that comment with respect to the notion that consumer curiosity was a sufficiently substantial government interest to warrant compelling speech. The problem we have here is that the so-called consumer curiosity that this overly detailed labeling regime ostensibly satisfies is far more likely to be confusing or misleading to consumers than it is to actually satisfy some informational interest that consumers may or may not have. Telling consumers where their particular cow or pig was born versus where it was slaughtered is not likely to lead to any significant new information on the consumer's part. All it may do is forced consumers to discriminate against meats without any health or safety justification for that consumer choice. That's the answer to your first question. The answer to your second question about the nature of the loopholes, you are right that those loopholes stem from the statute, but that doesn't mean that the regulation is any less arbitrary and capricious because of it. If the purpose of the regulation is to, you know, at best, and again, you know, courts have not bought this idea of a constitutionally significant consumer curiosity interest, but at best, what you have is occasional consumer information, sort of pockmarked by huge areas where that information is not forthcoming. So even that purpose is defeated by the loopholes. The loopholes are in the statute. They need to be carried forward into the regulation, but that just renders the regulation all the more capricious.
Okay. Are there more questions?
And our next question comes from Ron Nichols. Your line is now live.
Hi, just a sort of a detailed question. Do you have the actual case name and number and what court this will be heard in?
Yes. The caption, the short caption, because as Mark mentioned and as you can see in the slides, there are eight plaintiffs. The short caption is American Meat Institute, which is the lead plaintiff alphabetically, versus United States Department of Agriculture. So that would be AMI et al. Versus Department of Agriculture et al. It's case number 13-1033. It was filed in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. So that's the federal district court here in D.C.
It's filed today?
It was filed late yesterday.
Okay, thank you.
And there appear to be no further questions coming from the phone lines.
Any more questions at all? Last chance? All right, well, be sure to check meetami.com for additional information and for a recording if you need any clarification. And if you have any follow-up questions, we will do our best to answer them. Mark is on travel in Wisconsin, but we can make arrangements to have you speak with him. And my cell phone number, if you need it, is 703-801-2238. Thanks to everyone for participating this morning.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect your lines at this time and have a wonderful day.